Hey there, welcome to LSAT Demon Daily Digest. I'm Ben Olson, that's Nathan Fox. Together we're the founders of LSATdemon.com and our weekly podcast, Thinking LSAT. Here's what we talked about this week.
We have a longish email here from M.
Okay, and M apologizes up front. I apologize for the long email. Okay.
You know.
Let's see what you got.
The best apology is to...
cut it.
cut it down.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
Okay. That's a skill, by the way, Em, that we can all get better at. I'm writing this email to ask about some tips regarding reading comp. To put it in context, I just finished the third year of my undergrad degree in Canada, and my CGPA... Oh, what's a CGPA? Is that a Canadian GPA?
Must be Canada, yeah.
Okay. A CGPA is 4.0 on a 4.3 scale. Also, I just finished this academic year with a year average of 4.2. Okay, sounds like you're killing it. I don't know if that means anything in the States, but in Canada, most law schools look at your CGPA and last 2 years. I started studying for the LSAT in late December 2021, and my diagnostic was 137. I spent hundreds of dollars on Kaplan books and Seven Sage, and after a month of diligent studying, 1 to 2 hours a day, my accuracy had not improved, and neither did my overall score. I then saw videos of Ben talking about the demon on YouTube and decided to give the demon a try. Since I've been with the demon, my score has increased to a 155. Not great, far from my target, but still a decent improvement from my diagnostic. Yeah, you got to focus on your progress. I wouldn't worry about the fact that you're not where you want to be yet.
I mean, after a month, well,
that's...
I think M is underestimating how long and hard this process might be. I mean, I know M from classes, and M asks a ton of questions, and they have a tone of like put upon a little bit, like you can feel the burden, like it's as if it's this person who's been studying for 9 months, but now what I'm seeing is a month of diligent studying with Kaplan and Seven Sage.
Mm-hmm.
1 to 2 hours a day.
Mm-hmm.
And 1 to 2 hours a day, that's great. But I mean, a month, 1 to 2 hours a day, no progress. Well, I mean, that's bad materials. But it's also just a month.
Mm-hmm.
And now, kind of instantly with the demon, go from 137 to 155, which is an amazing amount of improvement in... Like, I think if I'm
2 months,
correct,
maybe?
I think M has been around with the demon for like a month.
Okay. Huh.
So,
well,
I mean, I think
M started in December, but yeah, I don't know. Okay.
Oh, in December. Okay. All right. It's been a couple months.
Yeah. A couple months here, a month there, and a couple months here. But anyway,
month there,
a
couple months here, but 3 months. Still 18 points progress from the diagnostic, which is pretty damn good for 3 months.
Yeah.
So it's like, I don't know, you know, people get so discouraged, and instead maybe you need to be kind of counting your blessings a little bit.
Your blessings. That's a first I think I've heard from you, Nathan. That's pretty good.
I mean, I think a little bit of gratitude can go a really
long
way.
Oh, I don't disagree. I just felt like I was like back in Sunday school all of a sudden. Count your blessings.
I'll
Nathan's
leave that one.
Great, Nathan. Great teacher, Nathan. Okay, so anyways, yeah. Look, there are people who have been at it for a year, right? Sometimes. That's a great amount of progress. I'd be excited about that.
Yeah.
I'm averaging.
You should be excited about this amount of progress. Yes.
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm averaging -6 to -4 on games. I finished the first three games with 100% accuracy, but never get to the fourth game. Don't worry, you'll get there. Constantly.
That's, by the way, just let me interrupt again, but like plainly, you just haven't put the work in yet.
No,
that's all there is to
it. There's what? How many games again?
400, roughly.
400, yeah.
There's roughly 100 tests. We got 4 games per test. We've got roughly 400 games. And people think they've done a lot. And it's not that they haven't done a lot. But, you know, I press people all the time. I'm like, how many have you done? How many games do you think you've done? Rough estimate's fine. I don't care. Rough estimate. You don't have to count them up exactly. Just give me roughly, like, order of magnitude. How many games have you done?
20, Nathan. And I've done 20 games.
Exactly. Yeah. People are like, well, I've done like 10 sections worth. So like 40.
You're like 10% of the games. Okay.
Okay, good. You've done 10% of the available prep.
And did you even do all those games? Because sometimes they don't do the last game and they never get to them.
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, you're not yet perfect on the games, which we say is basically if you're not perfect on the games, then you're not prepared for the test. You need to get to perfect on the games, or else I think you're just leaving money on the table.
And by so perfect on the games, we really mean you need to become perfect. Just you need to become perfect.
Yes.
Like entirely as a
human. No, but on the LSAT logic games, I think you should be able to reliably score perfectly in 35 minutes or else you're not prepared to take the law school admission test.
Yeah.
I've seen so many people go from zero all the way up to perfect. And I know that it's not a matter of like magic knowledge or tricks. It's a matter of, did you put the work in or did you not put the work in? If you put the work in, you will eventually get to perfect on the logic games. And if you don't put the work in, then you might not get to perfect on the logic games. Sorry to be so like stark about it, but you know that it's like, okay, you've been at it for a few months, but in a few months, 1 to 2 hours a day, you're not gonna, he has not done all of the prep for the games, right? So there's a big area of opportunity there for him to just do the work.
Yeah.
Get to perfect on the games. Okay.
M continues constantly. Okay. Constantly -7 on logical reasoning. I usually get 4 or 5 wrong. So I guess you're not getting to 2 or 3. And a disappointing -15 on reading comp. My major requires heavy reading and writing. So I can't understand why my RC is so bad. I usually finish 3 passages and get 50% accuracy. When I drill RC, I'm anywhere between 50 to 100% accurate. Yeah, you know, heavy reading to me is actually probably hurting you. Usually what that means is your classes are giving you lots of books that you have to read within a short amount of time. So you're developing this ability to skim and get the gist. And you're not being tested on the exact understanding of what's being said. You're being tested on a very general what kind of happened roughly.
Yeah, and people conflate like verbosity with, you know, technical accuracy.
That's so weird. Like, that's exactly the phrase I was gonna say. That's the phrase I had in my head. Technical accuracy.
It's well,
have we been hanging out too much, Nathan?
Maybe we do. We have spent quite a lot of time together. We were talking yesterday, you know, I one thing I do in my classes a lot now is I'll share my screen, or it's, I just newly discovered this because I ripped it off from one of our awesome teachers who does this, but share screen so that I can then like highlight phrases in arguments as we're going.
Yep.
And the browser feature, I'm obsessed with right clicking and just getting the definition of terms, because people didn't understand what, like, they just were, they're reading the words. They're familiar with those words.
Oh, these are not uncommon words. Like the example you gave me yesterday was increase, and people didn't realize that that's a causal verb.
It was beautiful. It was a beautiful moment in teaching history, because the phrase was something along the lines of, recent studies have demonstrated that high sodium intake tends to increase blood pressure.
Yep.
I'll say it again. Recent studies have demonstrated that high sodium intake tends to increase blood pressure. And then it was like a comma. And I ignore everything that's coming after the comma for now. And I stop there and highlight it. And I forced the students to think about that with me. And I said, okay, I want to know if that's correlation or causation. That's a premise of the argument. Do we think that that premise is correlative, or do we think that that premise is causative? Are we talking about correlation here, or are we talking about causation here? And again, recent studies have demonstrated that high salt intake tends to increase high blood pressure.
Yep.
Or increase blood pressure.
Yep.
And the whole class just whiffed. I mean, just a total whiff. Like everybody in the class, literally 100% of the people who participated said that that was correlation.
Oh, I've seen that so many times. I'm sure you were getting it in the chat, right? Correlation, over and over and over and over again. Yep.
Yep. And it was like the echo chamber partially. Mm-hmm.
Yep.
And I'm looking at it and I'm like, I think you're wrong, guys. In fact, I'm pretty sure you're wrong.
Mm-hmm.
I started looking up the definitions of the words.
Yeah.
And I'm like, well, let's look up demonstrated. Mm-hmm. Or demonstrates, whatever it was. And it was like, basically, it means to prove.
Mm-hmm.
I'm like, okay, so these studies have proved a thing.
Yeah.
Like, this is true. This is not, they're not just hypothesizing this. They're not concluding this. They've proven this.
Yeah.
Okay, so we've got real good evidence here. And then I looked up increase. And yeah, increase. The first fucking word in the definition is cause. What does increase mean? Causes to rise.
Yeah. It's the tends to that throws people off, right? They think, oh, wait a second. It only happens most of the time. It doesn't happen all the time. So that
And I can't remember what the definition of that was, but it was like has a tendency to, or has a propensity to, or something like that. It's basically all it means is, it does this thing.
Yeah.
It has a way of doing this thing. Doesn't have to be 100% of the time, but it does. It does do it sometimes. But look,
the perfect example of this is smoking. It's not true that all smokers get lung disease.
No, but smoking tends to increase.
It tends to cause smoke. Yeah, lung cancer. People aren't getting lung cancer and scratching their head. I wonder why I got that.
Right.
You got it from smoking, even though it doesn't happen all the time.
Right. And even though people can get cancer who didn't smoke.
Sure.
The cause can be present without the effect. The effect can be present without the cause. Nonetheless, smoking causes lung cancer. It tends to increase your incidence of lung cancer.
Yep.
And it was real interesting because, you know, I spent literally like 10 minutes on this one phrase at the beginning of the first sentence. It was like the first half of the first sentence in the argument.
Yep.
And the students want to race ahead. They want to read what's coming next and what's coming next after that. And they want to try to answer the question. And it's like, but if you don't understand that they have provided a premise that is causal, then what are you doing? You're building on a shaky foundation from here. Like if you think that the premise was correlation and you're going to go into the answer choices looking for some kind of correlation, therefore causation flaw or something, you just didn't read carefully enough. But taking it back to M's actual email here.
Yeah.
M is like, do you see M patting himself on the back here with my major requires heavy reading and writing? It's like, I don't care. You're what? You think that that should lead to automatic like high scores on reading comp?
Well, notice what it requires. It requires heavy reading and writing. So he's got to read a lot, but there are different kinds of reading. The LSAT requires actually very light reading. You don't have to read very much. It's a column.
Yeah.
It's one column on an old school 8.5 by 11 page. That is nothing.
How much do computer science majors have to read?
Yeah. Not much, but they better read it really well.
Well, see, they don't have heavy reading and writing, but the reading and writing that they do is fucking code.
Yeah. You can't mess up a sentence there.
When you go to law school, you are going to be reading code.
Like it's literally called code.
Yes. It is. What is the code? Like, what is the criminal code? What is the number of the line of the thing in the criminal code book that we're going to use to put this person in prison?
Yeah.
It is a code, a criminal code. And there's civil code as well. and you're going to be reading code and you're going to be writing code. Look what M is doing. I mean, it's perfect. By the way, M, I hope that you're taking this advice because, like, I know your problem. I mean, you're finishing three passages with 50% accuracy.
You need to start finishing one passage with 100% accuracy. Right. Once you can do that consistently, then go ahead, do two. But let's get that 100% accuracy.
Yeah. Yeah. You need to focus on accuracy. You're worried. I guarantee that M is more worried about the fourth passage that he's not getting to.
Yep.
Than he is about the 50% accuracy on the passages that he is getting to. And that is never going to be successful. Like, that is not going to work. You have to change that seriously. You have to start taking it seriously. You have to start picking answers that are justified by what it said in the passage. You got to stop making shit up. You're not reading the passage well enough. You're not reading it carefully enough. You're not reading it as if it were code. Like, it either, you know, like a computer responds to, I mean, you either tell the computer exactly what to do, or the computer is like, can't do shit, nothing. Like, it's just going to do nothing, or it's going to give false, you know, the exact wrong output.
Well, here's an idea. If we put these reading comp passages into a computer, it would get all the right answers because the answers are just the 15 sentences. 15, by the way, M, and for everybody else out there, these passages have 13 to 17 sentences, average of 15 sentences per passage. That's all we're talking about here. So you got to get those 15 lines of code. If you put those in a computer, it would determine the correct answers for all these questions. No problem.
Yep. Yeah. You got to start picking answers that have better justification from the passage. You're just not answering the questions based on what it said in the passage.
Yeah. I want to go back to the thing, your 10-minute discussion with the class, right? I'm guessing that some people were probably thinking like, hey, why are we spending so much time on this? But if they learn that one idea demonstrates, or actually three ideas, demonstrates, tends to, and increases, and they walk away from that 10-minute, that's it, 10-minute discussion on those three terms, and they actually understand them now, they're going to see those same three terms over and over and over again.
Oh,
and
yeah.
Know exactly what they mean, as opposed to reading quickly, going, okay, yeah, I kind of see why C is correct, and then repeating the exact same problem on the next question.
Yeah, people, generally speaking, everybody needs to do fewer questions, but reach a deeper understanding of them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I was just talking to a girl yesterday who was frustrated with her lack of progress, and I was reiterating that there are basically six questions you need to ask yourself, probably more. There's at least six questions that you need to ask yourself when you miss a question.
Yeah,
and I won't take forever, but those six are, why is the right answer right? Everybody does that, by the way. They think that they do that part. Why is the right answer right?
Yeah.
But the part they don't do is, why didn't you pick it the first time? And how are you going to avoid making that mistake next time? Those are the two questions that people just neglect.
Mm-hmm.
Like, they look at it, they go, oh yeah, okay, I think I get it. They read the argument, they read the explanation. Yeah, yeah, okay, I see why it's right.
Yeah.
Okay, but why didn't you pick it? Like, why didn't you see why it was right the first time through? And how are you going to avoid making that mistake next time?
Yeah.
Because otherwise you're just going to go make that same mistake.
Yeah.
Then why is the wrong answer wrong? And people think they see that too. Oh, I see. Yeah, I see. Okay, well then why did you pick it? And how are you going to avoid making that mistake next time? There's additional questions that you could ask, by the way, which are, did I really understand the argument? Did I try to attack the argument? Did I understand the question? Could I have predicted the answer here? Now we're up to 10.
Mm-hmm.
10 different questions you could ask yourself for every single question you miss.
Yeah.
And I invite people to imagine, I mean, this would suck for you, but imagine if there was like a little tiny devil version of me on your shoulder. You could have an angel, Ben, on one shoulder and a devil, me, on
you
the
can
other,
do
side,
it.
On the other shoulder.
You can do it. It's okay.
Yeah, Ben Horn. Come to me. Come to the gym with me at 5:30 in the morning tomorrow, too. and then you got... You got the like super sarcastic me on the other shoulder going like, well, but I mean, here's what I really want. I want you to hear our voice in your head saying, can you explain to me why the right answer is right and why the wrong answer is wrong and why you made both of those mistakes on the same question? Can you, now I'm imagining myself with like judge's robes where I'm like sitting up there, you know, and I'm like asking counsel to justify, like, can you explain to me why you not only chose the wrong answer, but also didn't choose the right answer? That right answer, it was there on the page, wasn't it, counsel? Was it right there on the page when you did the question? It was right there.
Did you not read it?
Did you not read it? Because you vouched for this, you came into my court and you vouched for this other answer, this one. Counsel, you see why that's objectively wrong. I mean, these words, they have meaning. They don't mean a thing that answers that question. That question also has meaning. Counsel, did you read the question? Did you read the argument? Counsel, can you explain to me, counsel? You see this passage, right? You understand that? You see the question? We understand that? Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
Do you see this answer you chose? Okay. Do you understand how that answer does not answer the question correctly?
Yep.
Why did you do that, counsel? What? Explain to me.
They can look back at me. I can be like, you got it. Keep going. I'm going to encourage you, but you gotta answer the question.
Hey man. We're not doing this for our health. We're not doing it because, I mean, it is like kind of fun. Like I get a little bit of like glee out of it because it is kind of a fun little game to play.
Sign up for the demon and help Nathan with his mental health.
Help me have fun. Yeah. Well, but I mean, we're just, ultimately I'm not successful unless you fucking get it.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing that I'm trying to teach you, I swear to God, it's at least half of what I do. I'm just trying to teach you that you don't have to miss these questions. You can figure them out. But it's on you, man. It is on you to fucking figure it out and answer the question correctly. I can guide you toward the understanding. There's some times where you're going to misunderstand stuff. But half or more of your mistakes, and I guarantee with M, I mean, look what M's doing. Three passages with 50% accuracy. Dude, you're not fucking reading it. You're not reading the passage. You're not reading the question. You're not reading the wrong answer you choose. Some combination of those three things. You're just not reading it.
You're not taking the time to digest it and really understand it. You're reading like you do for school.
It's like that line from Pulp Fiction where it's like, you saw me wash them. And then Samuel L. Jackson's like, I watched you get them wet.
The guy who's like not
actually washing. It's when Travolta's washing his hands in the sink. He's got blood all over his hands because they killed Marvin. But he's washing his bloody hands in the sink, and then he takes Jimmy's hand towel and he's drying off his hand. And as he's drying off his hands, the towel is just completely covered in blood. And Samuel L. Jackson's like, "What the fuck, man? What are you doing? Like, well, you saw me wash him." I watched you get them wet.
Yeah.
And it's like, you saw me read the passage.
Yeah.
I saw your eyes go over the page and you think you read it. But I then also watched you pick the fucking wrong answer.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean what it plainly says something wrong.
Yeah.
And more than half of the time, still, no matter how many times I say this, more than half of my time is spent encouraging people to read it again.
Yeah, read it again.
Try it again.
More slowly. Read only half the sentence. When people hear read again, sometimes they reread the whole passage or they reread the whole paragraph or whatever. It's like, no. Reread the first part of the first sentence. Do you get that? Now let's keep going. By the way,
yeah,
you had two questions, right? One is like, why is the right answer right? And why is the wrong answer wrong? And then you had two sub questions for each of those. But
yep.
I just wanted to say that if anybody tries to answer these questions and they say to themselves, oh, okay, I see why C is correct and B is wrong because C is a better fit. I hear that phrase all the time. It's like, it's a better fit. It's useless. It's meaningless. And it means you've now probably walked into this territory where you've answered a question, but you haven't really answered it, but you think you have. So it gives you like satisfaction that is unfortunately meaningless.
Yeah, I could just see the judge. I mean, counsel, a better fit, counsel?
Can you elaborate on that? Can you clarify what you mean by a better
fit? Oh, what you mean to say is the right answer actually answers the question and the wrong answer completely fucking doesn't? Is that what you mean?
You mean the right answer is better?
So I can swear.
Yeah.
Yeah, ain't no better fit.
Yeah. Well, that's the definition of all the correct answers on the test. You could say that anytime.
Exactly.
Of course.
Yeah, that's value free. That's not, that is never the rationale. If you think you understand it because it's a better fit, then that means you do not understand.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Unless you can do better than that. Point is, you know, Em, I think you're like, you're trying to do way too much. You have no business finishing three passages. If you're at 50% accuracy, God, that's bad. I was going to say, try two passages with 100% accuracy, but Ben went all the way down to one passage with 100% accuracy.
Well,
and I think that's, you got to do one before you can do the next one. So yeah.
Well, it's the same philosophy I have with my kids all the time, right? We have this nice meal sitting on the table and they grab like 10 chicken wings. And it's like, wait, are you going to eat all that? Oh yeah, I'm going to eat all that. And then it's like chicken wing 6 and they're like, oh, I think I'm done. Can I go? And it's like, dude, now your chicken wings are covered in your ranch sauce, which is mixed with your, you know, corn slaw or whatever. And it's like, no one wants those chicken wings now. And we're not going to eat those. You can always take one. You could take one chicken wing, eat it. And there's a whole plate right there. You can take another one, right? Like there's nothing wrong with like, so M goes and does one passage, knocks it out of the park and looks at the time. Is like, oh yeah, I still got 14 minutes. Okay, fine. Carry on at that point. There's nothing wrong with doing more after you crush what you do. Anyways, M says, I had my heart set on going to school in Canada, but with my GPA and a good LSAT, I may have a chance at full rides at some T14 schools. Okay.
Seems like you're putting the cart way before the horse here, man. I don't know why we're talking. Like, what happened? I thought you were struggling to get any points on the reading comp.
Once I get past that problem.
Now you're like, I'm going to get a full ride to a T14. Okay. Well, I hope so, but
yep.
What?
I was originally born in the Middle East and I thought that counts as URM, underrepresented minority, but apparently it does not. Also, I have heard that LSAC is harsh when converting Canadian GPAs. So does LSAC have a grudge match against Canadian students or applicants? So I'm not sure how that will play out. Where are you getting this information?
Also, what are you talking about? I mean, you're just like, this is so wildly all over the place. Mm-hmm. Like, I thought you were writing, you know, this is like, it starts with an apology for the long email, writing in for advice on reading comp. And now we're getting into this, like, just all kinds of weird speculations about, I'm not sure there's even questions here, so I don't know what.
Yeah, M continues. I'm also not sure if American law schools are less willing to give full rides to Canadians over Americans. No. I have personal connections in California, so a school like UCLA or Berkeley intrigues me. Okay, we got to get the score to get in there. The bottom line is that I have a lot riding on my LSAT, as I'm sure everyone does. Therefore, I need to do something about my RC reading comp because it is the anchor weighing me down. Well, I'm glad we got back to reading comp, but I think we told you what you need to do. You're going to read one sentence at a time. You're going to ace the first passage. Once you do that, go ahead and work on the second.
I want to be real, real here. This does not sound like super lawyerly to me. This sounds like somebody who's looking for shortcuts. Reading comp is definitely an anchor that is currently weighing you down. It is one of your anchors. I mean, that's really bad. Like minus 15 on reading comp is bad times. You're going to become a professional reader and writer if you're going to be a lawyer. That is, you are going to be a gladiator of the English language. You're going to be the best reader in the room if you're going to be a successful lawyer. And right now, you're a terrible reader. Probably because of just lack of attention. You're trying to do too much. You're not really understanding what you're reading. Nothing's going in. And so then bad inputs equals bad outputs on the questions. And you're missing half of the questions. It's like really because you're just not being careful enough. You've got to learn. You got to slow way down. You got to focus on actually understanding what you're reading. You got to start getting 100% on one passage and then moving on to the next one. But I also, you know, like minus 7 on logical reasoning is not very good either.
Yeah.
And minus 4 to minus 6 on the logic games isn't very good either. And you've got like a lot of work to do across the board and all this other stuff. Like you've got good grades, but I just stop worrying about what's going to happen when LSAC converts your grades. I mean, get them uploaded, like have your transcripts uploaded and find out what that number is. But otherwise, stop thinking about it. Worrying about American law schools not giving full rides to Canadians, I've never heard of that ever. I don't think that's an issue. I think they want your LSAT because it'll raise their medians, because it'll raise their rankings in U.S. News.
Yep.
Yeah, you have a lot riding on your LSAT. And yes, everyone has a lot riding on their LSAT. You need to do something about that.
And, you know, the where you're at in reading comp is not good. So I'm going to agree with Nathan here. But at the same time, you've come a long way. Just keep going. And look, if you can do what you did in the last 2 to 3 months again, you're going to be in the upper 160s, which is a world of difference from where you are now. But how do you do that? You do that by mastering each individual sentence. That's all the LSAT is. It's a sum of sentences. You got
this. And it's
this.
A test of how hard you can work.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I mean, like lawyers work extremely hard. This is not the gravy train. This is a place where you're going to be successful in law because you love the work of lawyers and you want to work your ass off every day for the rest of your life. That's the people who are going to be successful in law. And you have an opportunity here, Em, to demonstrate how hard you're willing to work.
Yep.
And it could be months. You've got a long way to go. Diagnostic 137, you know, like that's those people. It's not usually not an overnight kind of a thing. We should go from 137 to you're talking about a full ride at a T14. That's not a leap that is, you know, like just kind of people make it in 3 months.
No, but you're learning things that your major will never teach you, apparently, because.
Yeah. Whatever this heavy reading and writing, it's garbage. You know, it's not the right useless. Kind of reading and writing. Yeah.
Yeah.
It's not with any stakes on it. It's just like bullshitting about history or bullshitting about English or whatever. Yeah. And it's like, that's just not what law is. Law is like, what are the facts? What is the code? How do the facts interrelate with the actual law here? And you've got to really deeply understand what things mean when you read them. So you've got to learn a whole new way of like being much, much more careful.
Yeah, this is a tangent and then we'll wrap it up. But
all right.
I think that it's much of a tangent, but it's something we've talked about before, but I'm sure our recent listeners have not heard in a long time. Some of the best test takers when it comes to the LSAT are people who did physics or econ or even computer science. Why? Because they're so exacting. Those majors are not about heavy reading. They're about understanding exactly what's happening. whatever it is that they're talking about. And
yeah, I've always thought that computer science was the major that does the best on the LSAT.
Yeah, there was a study that was done, and it was like, I forgot to include math, but it's like math, physics, these hard these hard sciences, econ too, which isn't necessarily as hard, but it's like, it's requiring you to think about the world in an exacting way as opposed to a loose and fluffy way. And that works.
It's just not this like, a lot of what happens in classes is this like lofty rhapsodizing about what you think the law should be.
Yeah.
But that's not what it actually, like, that's not what it is on the exams. On the exams, it's like, well, did you notice this fact in the fact pattern? And do you know this law over here that controls these facts? And can you talk about how this law is going to this fact is going to interact with this law? And can you anticipate the legal arguments that are going to be made on both sides of that? And it has nothing to do with like your fucking opinions of what you, I mean, it's not about justice and your ability to turn a phrase in some like highfalutin philosophy. It's just not about that. It's like, well, did you plug in this line of code to this line of code to create the output that we want?
Yeah.
And you either did or you didn't. Black and white kind of thing.
You did, right, or you didn't. It you did or you didn't. That's it. Yep. Email daily at LSAT. No, I'm agreeing with you. I'm not disagreeing. It's a great phrase to end on. You either did or you didn't. And that's how it is on the test. You either got the answer or you didn't. And you either understand why you did or you didn't. Or you figured out why you made that mistake or you didn't. It's not a gray area.
Hey there. Welcome to the LSAT Demon Daily. I'm Matt Dumont, an LSAT teacher and tutor at the LSAT Demon, and now a rising 3L at the University of Maryland. Yeah, with me is Becca Cumberbatch, also an LSAT teacher and tutor with the Demon, and also a rising 3L at Maryland Law. How you doing,
The good
Becca?
Thing about showing 3L on your fingers is you have to say win and lose.
And for those of you who can't see this because this is a podcast,
oops.
Becca is doing all the 3L things with her fingers.
And she's doing a good job.
That's for the YouTube special. It would be great. How are you, Becca?
Just, real peachy. Just finished my last final yesterday afternoon. And so when I taught class this morning at LSAT brunch, 11 a.m. Eastern time, by the way, I just really was in a great mood. And I don't know if I was, as effervescent and contagious as I felt, but I feel good. How about you, Matt? How's life?
I'm good. 3L's on the way. I'm just excited for the summer, excited about the job stuff. What are you doing for the summer?
So I am very excited. I got an internship this summer with Baltimore City Public Schools Chief or Office of Legal Counsel. And so I'm going to be working with them to keep the schools running, which is kind of my jam. How about you, Matt? What are you doing?
I am judicial interning for Judge Baran on the Maryland Court of Appeals, which is Maryland's like Supreme Court. I'm going to be listening to oral arguments and pretending that I know how to write a bench memo. It's going to be great. It's going to be
Fake
great.
Fake it till you make it.
Fake it till you make it.
That's awesome.
I'm really excited. I'm excited about your job. It sounds awesome. And Lord knows Baltimore City Schools, they need all the help they can get.
Yes. Happy to provide, especially if they want some more help that they pay me for after I graduate from law school. You hear that? I know Baltimore City Public Schools loves listening to Thinking LSAT podcasts. So.
And the LSAT Demon Daily, yeah. The reason we're here today is we got some questions about whether LSAT prep prepares students for law school. And so I wanted to bring you on just because, you're just finished your second year. And so let's talk about what the LSAT does prep you for and what it does not. And then maybe we can point some people to some helpful resources as we wrap up. So what do you think the LSAT preps you for law school?
So one thing, as I like to call myself quite the reading comp guru, I definitely will defend until I die that LSAT reading comp is a great preparation for a lot of the kind of reading that you do as a law student, with very dense and very convoluted texts that are not immediately interesting and are not written to be easy to comprehend. And the strategies that you use to be very good at reading comp on the LSAT, for instance, being able to talk back to the text and ask questions and summarize what you've read and predict where they're going, all of those things that we do in class every day are the things that you should be doing while you are reading your textbooks and reading opinions and all these old documents and all this stuff that you read for law school. You have to be able often to manufacture interest in what you are reading, and you can do that successfully on reading comp, master reading comp on the LSAT, and directly transfer those skills. So that's one. What about you, Matt? What's something you think you really see the benefit?
I'm going to piggyback on reading comp and say that I think reading comp and like the identification of the main point is an exercise of identifying the case holding. That directly translates. And the way that I've been challenging some of the students that I've worked with at the Demon is saying like, hey, I want you to tell me what this is and why I care. I typically say of like, what's the topic and why do I give a shit? And like that essentially is the main point, right? And so what is the main point of a 60-page case? Like you have to do the same kind of thing. And then I challenge people to try to do it in as few words as possible. I'm like, hey, try to do this in 8 words or less. And they're like, ah, I can't do that. And I just point to the idea of two cases that I think most people are pretty familiar with, and that's Plessy v. Ferguson, which is separate but equal. Mm-hmm. That's essentially the case holding. We got 3 words for that. And then the repudiation of Plessy is Brown v. Board, which you're, of course, going to study in your con law classes, where the holding is separate is inherently unequal. 4 words. Mm-hmm. And so that sort of main point identification on reading comp is really, really helpful and does translate to a useful law skill. I want to pivot to logic games because that's my jam.
Yeah.
And I argue that logic games, I didn't even realize this, but logic games, even their physical structure of how they present the game rules to you, is almost identical to how statutes are drafted. You have like a little paragraph, like giving the preamble of a statute, and then you have a bunch of rules of like, did this person commit murder? Yes or no? Here's the necessary and sufficient conditions. And so like all of those kind of things, the concepts of sufficient and necessary and like that directly translates. In fact, it's all over cases. You'll see justices literally say, this is sufficient, not necessary, or this is necessary, not sufficient. They say that all the time. So those concepts that you learn in logic games also translate, but even just the structure, the practice of reading that stuff looks like statutes. It looks like the rules of evidence. It looks like the penal code. And so like all of those kind of things that you're practicing on logic games, it's priming you, it's training you, even if you don't necessarily know it, towards future legal school. Wow, this is terrible how I'm saying this. Your future legal education.
Yeah, and I think that's a good point too, because what's going to happen in your criminal law final, regardless of where you go, is your professor is going to write a little story called a hypo, and he's going to say, this guy robbed a store and then he ran away and the officer did this, and da, 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 right? All of these things. And you are going to have to go back to the rules of what, according to the statute, what does it, if I want to charge him with robbery, what rules do I have to follow? And you're going to do the exact same analysis like with a logic game where it says, you know, if we put the orange CD on top, then the red one has to be below. Same thing. Oh man, if he doesn't have this mens rea, then I'm going to have to use. It's as if they knew what they were doing.
They knew what they were doing. Yeah. What about LR? What do you, you talked a little bit about reading comp. I talked about logic games. What do you think about LR?
Definitely. It is. I mean, first of all, LR is bite-sized reading comp. So, and I will be beating that drum until the day I die. So already you're still practicing those same reading skills. The other thing that I think LR, because it's shorter, it hones in on, did they make that point ironclad? And when you do legal writing exercises in your legal writing courses, they're going to give you cases and they're going to give you a situation, and you have to write an argument as well as you can to say, my client is not, you should not be charged with this or whatever. All that to say, you're going to use this skill of looking at an argument and saying like, well, they have that huge flaw right there. Oh, look, answer choice D. Instead of finding answer choice D, you're going to say, there's that huge flaw right there. So I better find a way to use this case to fill in that flaw or whatever. And I think because you get the smaller pieces with LR, you get to zero in on that a lot more and kind of analyze, is this a good argument? And if not, how am I going to deal with that? That's how you write.
Yeah. I want to add to that, that I feel like the vast majority of LR is debunking bad arguments, right? I mean, there certainly must be truths and supported and paradoxes and like that kind of stuff. And those are probably, you know, 8 to 10 questions per section of 25, maybe a little bit more, maybe a little bit less. But the vast majority of these things are identify the issue with this argument and then strengthen it, weaken it, tell me what the point is, et cetera. And like, that's a case walking in the door for your future client where they have a shitty case and you're like, oh, this case is weak. How do we strengthen it? Or the opponent's case is weak. Let's attack it, you know, those kind of things. So I think that there's like these little bite-sized opportunities to be a lawyer, to be an advocate, which is again, training those skills towards law school. The other thing that I really like about that, because they're not good arguments, they're actually flawed arguments, I think we learn so much more from making mistakes and grading other people's mistakes. And so I think the LSAT in that way is actually brilliant because they're giving you all these opportunities to learn from mistakes about logic flaws and those kind of things where you're essentially the teacher in that moment teaching the LSAT what they did wrong. And so I just like how that juxtaposition is useful for training people.
And that does, this is the other drum that I'll never stop beating. That does also remind me of the very important point of if you absolutely hate what you're doing on the LSAT, there's a very good chance you're going to hate law school. Yeah. And there is a little heart to heart that you need to have with yourself called, this test is actually pretty, I don't think it's accurate to everything. We're going to talk about that in a second, but this test is pretty good at giving a taste of what is law school like. Am I good at some of the skills I need? Can I gain some of those skills? And if you just hate it,
yeah,
literally do anything else.
To talk about conditional reasoning, I think the LSAT and getting the skills and those kind of things that the LSAT test is necessary for success in law school, while not being sufficient, right?
Yeah.
Like you need to be able to do these things. And I would hope that you enjoy it at least somewhat. Mm-hmm. You don't have to enjoy it to do well at the LSAT.
Right.
You also don't have to enjoy law school or enjoy being a lawyer. Right. I encourage you to do something that you enjoy in your life. And so if you don't enjoy those things, maybe think a second thought.
Yeah.
Agreed. Okay. So what do you think that the LSAT doesn't prepare? And I have some resources that I'm going to read about in a second, but what areas do you think that it doesn't necessarily prepare you?
So depending on how you're studying for the LSAT and the things in your life, a major factor in law school that obviously can't be reflected on a standardized test is the massive amount of stuff juggling, right?
Yes.
You have time commitments. You have 5 different classes. You might have a clinic. You might have, there's all these things going on.
All the extracurriculars as well, like moot court, mock trial, clubs, all that stuff too. Yeah.
Yeah. Exercise, showering, eating food. Because those suckers, I know some people have dropped those by the wayside.
Did you do anything outside of the norm, say during your time at law school so far?
So weird you should ask, Matthew. I would say probably the weirdest thing about me as a person is that I intentionally had an entire human being during law school, my son, who kicks ass and is better at anything than anyone else. Coming for you, Michael Jordan. But I would say that although possible, you know, definitely all of that juggling that has to be done, that's just not something that is reflected on the LSAT, and also there's nothing wrong with the test that it can't do that. But I do think that maybe the majority of your success in law school is about juggling and keeping up with all these things, and sometimes knowing which thing to drop. You can't do it all. And every now and then you have to not go to that meeting, and you have to not get, you know, that reading done at that time. So that ability to have this sophisticated time management, that's often a life experience. You just had to have it. And maybe you learn it from the first time in law school. But I think that's a big one.
Yeah, I want to double down on that. I think people, the LSAT can teach you some things about hard work. It is a test of how hard you are willing to work. You know, I came in with a 152 and a year later I walked out with a 171. And I know that was a kind of a long journey for me, but I was working while doing this and like all the things. I think that there's some aspects of that juggling, but as Sarah Camuni, who was just on the Demon Daily earlier this, or I think it was earlier this week, she talked about how 1L is the hardest she's ever worked. And I would agree with that sentiment. I was reading probably 8 hours or more a day, 7 days a week, plus going to class, plus my work at the DMN. I don't recommend working in law school, but I also don't have loans. So I'm not taking those loans, which I encourage people not to do. Don't take loans if you can avoid them. It's just paying your future self is paying interest. So anyway, that juggling, I completely concur with. Just the sheer amount of reading, the LSAT is not going to prepare you for that. The depth of the reading, the analysis, that kind of stuff, again, is not going to prepare you for, which is why I'm going to turn to a book recommendation list that we have at the DMN. The first book is Don't Go to Law School Unless. It's just a great book for everybody to read. Then some actual sort of like doctrinal classes or doctrinal books. Getting a Running Start, Your Guide to Your First Year Curriculum, is excellent. Getting to Maybe How to Excel on Law School Exams is excellent. And then there's a bunch of other things like Legal Writing in Plain English, Point Made, Style, Lessons in Clarity and Grace. We have an entire list of these kind of things at the DMN, and I'm going to put that in the show notes. But I encourage you, like, check out some of these books that we're recommending. I'm also going to recommend that I recorded a podcast. It was episode 161 with Michael Hill. He's now a rising 3L at GW in DC. And we talked about some advice for incoming students just to sort of think about. And so there's some resources there. So check those out. They'll be in the show notes, that kind of stuff. Becca, where did you study for the LSAT?
Okay, so I was finishing a master's in school administration and teaching middle school English, as well as, of course, you know, studying for the LSAT and all that. So I did study. I did almost all my study at my kitchen table at my house in Peoria, Illinois. Thank you very much. And I would definitely say that, as much as we just said that the LSAT itself doesn't prepare you for the juggling, just FYI, the realities of your life while studying for it might. Yeah. So there's a counterpoint. But yeah, how about you, Matt?
I took a prep course from Nathan and learned all this stuff from Nathan and Ben and the DMN. We were saying before we came on the air, it's funny, we were sitting in criminal procedure this entire semester, and like every time something from the LSAT nerd land would come up, we'd be like, ha, that person mistook sufficient for necessary. Like, so we just keep laughing about that and sending each other like LSAT memes while we're in actual law school. So,
and that's why we don't have any other friends.
Sad day.
That's a lie. We're both extremely popular.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, I mean, truly, you do sit in classes, and especially something about criminal classes, for what it's worth, yeah. that always does seem to be where it really comes up. But it's just like, well, there's the LSAT. There's the LSAT. Just yeah. like painfully yeah. obvious.
Especially yeah. criminal constitutional. Like that yes. was the most I think I've ever seen it.
Totally. Yeah. And evidence. Yeah. I do think that, you know, the way that we are able to teach our classes at the Demon, because like we're very honest and we're very transparent, the way we're able to teach our classes and talk about things and even put our own personal experience in it, I do think gives a fairly accurate representation. But of yeah. course, you also only see me for an hour in class while I'm doing this thing I'm already really good at and I already really like doing. Yeah. So even that, like there's always going to be a learning curve by the time someone actually goes to law school themselves and
yeah.
experiences it. So I think part of it is accepting, which a lot of law students cannot do this, but you have to accept that you're not prepared for everything and you're going to have to learn it on the fly. And that whole thing of like, okay, I'm in here and I've got to learn it as I go is what lawyers do as well, very frequently. So that's a skill in and of itself. You can prepare in a lot of ways. Your LSAT prep will help you. But at the end of the day, you have to be the person who can show up and figure it out when somebody says, here you go. Yep. You have to take it and figure it out as you go.
And I think the LSAT is a great training tool for that concept. I think that's yeah. a great place for us to wrap it up. You can learn more of this kind of stuff by dropping into Becca's or my classes. We're open books. We talk about this kind of stuff all the time with our students. So feel free to stop by. Becca teaches predominantly reading comp and LR. I teach predominantly logic games in the Demon Live. Awesome. This has been great.
Yes.
Thanks for being on, Becca.
Oh my gosh, what a joy. Thanks everybody for listening. And we do hope if you're able, we'd hope to see you in class. And if not, thanks for taking the time to just like know some stuff.
We have an email here from Rachel.
Okay. Hey guys, I heard a Bruce Lee quote the other day. Quote, if you always put limits on everything you do, physical or anything else, it will spread into your work and into your life. There are no limits. There are only plateaus. And you must not stay there. You must go beyond them. Rachel continues, yes, there is a hard limit on the LSAT, but I'm nowhere close to 180. I know what score I need to get into the schools I want, so I must go beyond my plateau. I plan to win this game. Thanks for encouraging me to relentlessly push myself forward. Best, Rachel. P.S. In case you book junkies want to dive in, I heard the quote in Moonwalking with Einstein by Joshua Foyer. Foyer?
I would just say four, probably.
Four. Okay.
F-O-E-R. I don't know. Four. Moonwalking with Einstein. Okay. I'm going to go on Libby right now, and I'm going to see if I can request that delivered automatically to my Kindle for free from the public library. If you have a Kindle, or the Kindle app, you owe it to yourself to get the Libby app as well, because it is amazing to get free books. Have you read
I've heard of this book.
Moonwalking with Einstein?
No, but it was mentioned in an audiobook I was just listening to about 2 weeks ago. I knew the title sounded familiar, but it has to do with, I think, memorizing things. And I think this person became very good at it, if I remember correctly. Yeah.
Okay, so it was just like a you can do anything sort of a thing. So can I memorize 1,000 digits of pi or some shit like that?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And just like pushing yourself.
This person figured it out and like won something, I think, with memorizing. Yep.
There are no plateaus. You must not stay there. Sorry, there are only plateaus. And you must not stay there, though. You must go beyond them, according to Bruce Lee. What do you think about that?
I do think about this. I was listening to something else where someone was talking about how, you know, as you get older, you, whatever it is that you're pursuing, you should be progressing in that field or that career or whatever it is, right? And if you're not, what's going on? And I think about like our work with the LSAT, like it's so much different than where we were 10 years ago, right? The product that we're offering, everything we know about it, is just increasing and getting better and growing. And anyways, the point here is that I think some people in their life or in their career, they get on a plateau and they just stay there. And it's like, hey, that's not fulfilling. Like, move the ball forward in some way. Is that true on the LSAT? I think so. I think you can get to a point and you may decide that the plateau is long enough that you just want to stick with the score you got. But our advice is always the same. What are the questions you're getting wrong? Can you figure them out and learn from them? If you can, you will eventually break through that plateau.
Yeah. It makes me think about golf. It's the beginning of golf season here in the mountains. And I've been playing a lot and I'm okay. I've played golf since I was in high school, and I am not better than I was in high school. If anything, I keep thinking this will be the year that I get better.
Mm.
But the truth is I'm not willing to work at it.
Mm.
So I am on a golf plateau, and I might, you know, if I look at the remaining 40 years of my life or whatever,
yeah,
I'm not going to get better when I'm 80. I'm definitely going to get worse. The question is, do I keep playing golf? And maybe I need to sort of think about it in a kind of a different way, right? Like, I know what it would take to get better, which is play all the time, for one thing. And I am going to do that this season.
But play well, too, right? You don't want to reinforce bad habits.
No, right. Well, okay, so good point. I'm planning to play a lot, and I'm planning to give it, well, I'm planning to, like, be sober, and I'm planning to give it my full attention, mm-hmm. you know, like, try hard, mm-hmm. and try to focus on hitting one good shot at a time. I know, like, kind of how to play well for me. You know, I'm never going to be on the PGA Tour. I couldn't even play in college, but I'm okay. And I enjoy it. Golf is weird because it's handicapped, right? You like are always getting shots and giving shots.
Mm-hmm.
So it's all just relative. And it's like, you can always just have a fun competition, even with somebody who's way worse than you, because you just give them a bunch of shots.
Yeah.
And it all just kind of evens out over time, and you end up just so trading.
There's a less of an incentive to up your game.
Well, there is, yeah, because like, so far I'm 0-3 versus Wade this season.
Yeah.
My best buddy who lives right here in the neighborhood. We play golf together all the time, and I've lost 3 matches in a row. And so, you know, $5 NASA, I'll lose $5 or I'll lose $10. And I keep losing that money to him. But then our handicaps will adjust. And instead of me giving him a shot, he'll have to give me a shot. And then I'll play a little bit better and he'll play a little bit worse. And then we'll trade that $5 back and forth, you know, for the whole season. And that's just kind of how it works. But every one round, I still do want to play well. But the thing that I don't want to do, you know, it's like, hey, I miss a lot of 4-footers. I just miss short putts. I do other dorky shit too. I'm not that good at golf, and I could fix it if I went down to the putting green and sat there and hit 100 4-footers in a row. I could fix it. Am I going to do that? No, because I just don't care. I like golf, but I don't like practicing. I don't like.
You have to decide which plateaus are worth overcoming.
Right. I have to decide which game I want to play, and I need to think about it kind of differently. Right. Like, I enjoy playing well, but I don't enjoy practicing, which is like, to objectively improve at golf relative to the world, I would have to practice.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, it's sort of like I need to choose a different game, which is have more fun playing golf. You know, how can I have more fun playing?
What can I add to the game to make it more fun, even if I don't improve my strokes?
Or just change my mental perspective to where I don't, you know, because like, if I keep expecting to go out there and shoot par, I might once this whole season, you know, like, I know I'll have one great round at some point. But what I need to do is like, enjoy more the the walk and the exercise and the little competition and the friendly bullshit out there. And I need to have fun with it and work on that part. Cause like, I'm not going to break out of the plateau really with my scores. I don't know.
Yeah. So Bruce Lee is saying here, there are only plateaus and you must not stay there. You must go beyond them. And you're saying, well, I am going to stay on some plateaus because to go beyond them is not worth the end result.
Well, right? You're not going to
live
forever.
But for other plateaus, I'm going to go beyond them because it's worth it to me to go beyond them, right?
Yeah.
You have to decide what plateaus do you want to surmount and which ones are you going to say, I'm perfectly fine staying here, because you can't surmount all plateaus. That is for sure. You can't win all games.
You're not living forever. You're not going to like stay in perfect health for your entire life. You're not going to keep, you know, like your running times or your weightlifting or whatever it is, like you're up against a hard limit at some point. You will start to physically decline and you will start to mentally decline. And anyway, I'm not sure what all of this has to do with the LSAT.
What it has to do is if you're at a plateau and it's important to you to go higher, and it should be important to you if you want to go to law school and you don't want to pay. And I think those things are things that should be valuable to you if you're pursuing this path. Because there's so much money on the line. You have to, the presumption is do the best you possibly can and go for free or don't go. That's the presumption. So you can rebut it, but that's on you. And so this is a plateau you should try to overcome or get out and go play a different game, which is exactly what you're saying. You're like, you know, I'm going to stay on this plateau in golf and I'm not going to advance, at least in this regard. And that's fine because you've decided not to compete on that level. You're competing on a different level, going and having fun.
Yeah, like just sort of choose a different game to play.
Yep.
Rachel seems to have chosen the law school game to play, and if she wants that scholarship, then that means she's going to have to play the LSAT game. And yeah, so figure out, she says she knows what score she needs to get into the schools she wants. And then she needs to do what it takes. It would be the equivalent of me deciding, no, I want to be a 4 handicapper instead of an 8 handicapper.
Yep.
I can't miss fucking 3-foot putts. I'm going to go to the golf course today and I'm going to go hit 100 3-footers. And I'm going to do that again tomorrow and the next day and the next day. And next thing you know, I'd be a 4 handicap. I mean, I know I would.
Yeah.
But I would have to do that work because I know what if I decided that's what I wanted, then that's what I would have to do. So yep. Rachel knows what she wants. She knows what she has to do. She basically has to do one question at a time.
Yep.
Okay. Thanks, Rachel. Hope that was useful.
We have an email here, a long email from Karina.
Hey there. I just finished your recent podcast, Am I Ready to Take the LSAT? I'm a newer student who is truly regretting not starting LSAT Demon sooner. Anywho, during the podcast, you both mentioned how we should take multiple tests to strive for a better score. However, when I went to an open house and also an admissions seminar from one particular school in South Florida, they made it seem like multiple LSAT scores was one of the worst things you can do. They mentioned also that if you have more than one LSAT, you should be writing an addendum stating why. Not to mention the look of dread on their face if your LSAT score after your first one came back lower. I believe a direct quote was, we will think you didn't take the LSAT seriously the first time.
Huh?
What's your gut telling you?
It's just, none of this matters. Like, really? They're going to
ignore. Why do the law schools say it, though?
Why do they say it? They want you to apply with the score you have now.
This is bullshit scare tactics coming from a school that wants to rip you off, Karina. They don't want you to be a better applicant. They know that if you achieve a higher LSAT, you will not go to their dumb school. So they try to scare you with, well, but if you scare, boy, you might score lower. Oh my God.
Don't take it again. You might get higher and actually leave us in the dust. That's what they're really worried about.
Well, they fucking know that you will. They know that if you improve significantly on the LSAT, you'll end up going to a better school, probably for money. They don't want you to be a better applicant, Karina. They feel like they've already got their hooks in you.
If you're sitting there talking to them, yeah.
Yeah. If hey, it's just them. I mean, is it shady? Are they pretending to be your friend when they're really not? Yeah. But rationally, you know, are they behaving as an econ would, in the words of Thaler and, you know, like economists speak? They're behaving in their own economic best interest.
And so are we, right? We're telling you to keep studying for the LSAT, which generally means that helps us because you study with us longer, we get paid more. But you have to ask yourself, okay, what's going to happen if I go and increase my score by 10 points? Totally reasonable proposition. Go to LSATdemon.com/scholarships. I don't know, the data's there. The numbers are there. You're going to get better offers. You're going to get more money.
No, I think, your scholarships based on your LSAT and your GPA, and that's just based on your highest LSAT score. The number of times you took it, irrelevant. Addendum, irrelevant. You took it again and got lower, irrelevant. What's your highest score?
Yep.
Your highest score plus your LSAT GPA is how we figure out whether schools are likely to offer you scholarships or not. These schools don't want to acknowledge that because they just want you to apply right now to only their school. That's their incentive.
Because then they can turn around and accept you. And because you're now boxed into, do I go or not go to this school? And that's your only choice. You're going to have a bias toward going and paying. Yeah.
And they can charge you whatever they want because you've declared your true love to them.
Yeah.
You know, you're just like only in bed with them. They don't want you working out. They want you to be beholden to them. They want you to be desperate to stay with them.
Yep.
Anyway, Karina continues. Typically, I wouldn't fret too much about this, but when I submitted my transcripts and received my accumulated GPA, it was horrendous. Let me just say my overall undergrad GPA was maybe average. 3.5, if that's even average these days, ? I already thought that was bad enough. I've been a long time off and on student due to having kids and jobs and career. So law school was never on my mind until these past 2 years. I buckled down and recently finished my bachelor's in 2021 while getting COVID twice that year. So fun. Okay, that's a bummer. This is totally irrelevant. The only thing that matters is what is your LSAC GPA?
Yep.
Now I'm in my early 30s, totally hating my younger self. But the reason for this background story is that I already have to write an addendum on why my accumulated GPA is so low. It's under a 3.0. I thought you had said 3.5. I'm confused. Listen, Karina, who gives a shit? What's your LSAC GPA? Go to lsatdemon.com/scholarships. Put in your LSAC GPA. Maybe it's a 2.8. Fine, whatever. Put that number and then play with various LSAT scores and see how that affects your likely scholarship offers. You don't need to write addenda. You need to get a good LSAT. She continues, I'm already feeling that I am at great disadvantage for getting in anywhere, hence why I need a killer LSAT score and no other, I guess, red flags. On the brighter side, I am not pursuing any T14 schools, even though listening to your podcast has me feeling like I should wait for that 180 and shoot my shot at Harvard. Even with a 180, Karina, you're not getting into Harvard. Sadly, I am already super established where I am with a home, 5 kids, 3 dogs, and my husband and I run our own companies in the area.
Why are you going to? Why are you going to law school?
Totally. Yeah.
This you is run just your making own me companies?
Think that law school, awesome. Period, is a bad idea.
Yeah.
I have 4 schools I can apply to and easily drive there and back every day, which is a plus. Okay, that's good. 4 schools, that's better than one.
Yep.
Other good news is that I already have a job waiting for me that ties in with my current business. I just need to get into one of these 4 with the best scholarships I can get, and then, of course, graduate and pass the bar. But until then, one step at a time. And then she asks if we're ever going to do bar prep classes. Probably not. We'd have to teach a different bar prep for every state. We're not doing that.
No, we are good at the LSAT. We're going to take that and we're going to keep getting better and better. We don't care about any of this other shit.
Yep. Sorry if that was unnecessarily long. It was. Thanks for reading, Karina. Karina, you already have. Well, so I was going to say, don't go to law school. Just don't. Like, what are you doing? You have an established business. You and your husband each run your own companies. Great. You've already won.
Grow
You've got
those
a home.
Companies.
You've got five yeah. kids, three dogs, two businesses. What the fuck are you trying to go to law school for? But it seems as if she has an actual plan that requires a JD. We don't know what that plan is. But taking her at her word, she needs a JD for some opportunity that ties in with her current business. That's great. Do it. But don't pay for law school. It would be a huge waste of money.
Yeah.
So the way you're going to do that, Karina, is you're going to get the very best LSAT you can possibly get. Go to LSATdemon.com/scholarships. Put in your 2.8 or whatever it is. Then put in 150, 160, 170 and see what that does. You don't need a 180. But you might need a 170.
By the way, if you can't go for free to any of these four schools, you should consider dropping this pursuit.
Yes. Well, there aren't even any good law schools in South Florida. So, you know, mediocre at best.
Mm-hmm.
So you need to go to these schools for free. Yeah. Or else you're wasting money.
Yep. And time.
Your GPA, I really don't think your GPA is going to hold you back. I could do the analysis for you, but you need to do this for yourself. Again, it's LSATdemon.com/scholarships. Put in your GPA, whatever it is, your LSAC GPA. And we don't give a fuck about the addenda. We care what the numbers are.
Mm-hmm.
Put your LSAT, play with that LSAT number and your GPA, and then just keep studying LSAT until you get the score that is going to get you the scholarship you need. I want to say one more thing about multiple attempts. Do not take the test until your practice tests indicate you're ready. We're not advocating for you to just randomly keep shooting shots at the LSAT. That's not going to be effective. What is going to be effective is doing lots of practice tests. They're all in the Demon, plus the help that you need in order to improve.
The explanations,
mm-hmm. videos, written explanations, the ask button, a whole team of tutors that are there to help you. You can make real improvement in the LSAT. And these fuckers who are telling you, oh, don't take it again because you might score lower. Well, you're not going to take it the first time until you're ready. And then if you take it again, you're going to go. The reason why you're taking it again is because your practice tests are better than your official score on record. And you know, with some certainty that you can score higher. And even if you do score lower, all you'll do is just take it again. Ultimately, all they're going to care about is the highest score. And they're full of shit if they say anything else.
Or they're stupid. They're extraordinarily stupid because they're not playing the game.
That's
right.
It's possible. They are bad law schools. So it is possible that they're just stupid and don't know how to play the game.
Yeah.
But Karina, trust me. Get the highest LSAT you can possibly get, and your practice tests are the way to get there. Not official attempts, but practice tests. Study hard, study as long as it takes, get your practice tests up to the level where these schools will be forced to give you a scholarship. And then you breeze in there with whatever your high score is. You're just going to be like, listen, I know I only have a 2.8. I also have a 170. You're giving me a full ride or I'm not going to your dumb school.
Yeah.
And that's how the negotiation, you're not going to say those words, but that's how it will, in fact, go down.
Today we have an email. I don't know where this came from.
Yeah, it's anonymous. It says, thanks for all the advice. I'm trying to help a family member. We still have enough left in the 529 plan to pay full tuition. That's the 529 is a tax code thing. There's a type of an account that you can open for your kids. Ben, do you have 529s for your kids?
I don't. I didn't like all the restrictions.
Yeah, I had a 529 for my niece, who I adore, who it was her birthday yesterday. Happy birthday, Haley. She's 15. I started a 509 when she was a kid, or a 529 when she was a kid. And I then realized, like, man, I really don't think that this is going to be money well spent.
Hmm.
I stopped funding the 529 because I was like, this shit, all I'm doing is committing to paying for wildly overpriced shit. Why would I do that?
Yeah.
Like, I certainly wouldn't save money for law school tuition.
Yeah.
And I feel the same way about undergrad tuition these days. I just can't imagine that paying $50,000 a year makes any sense. I think people should be going to community college. They should be getting scholarships. They should be working their way through school, apprenticeships. There's got to be some other way. Like, we don't need to be saving six figures, putting them into these accounts, even though they are tax advantaged, but putting all this money into these accounts just so that you can promise to give it to some nonprofit institution, educational institution down the road, like literally saving up $250,000 to waste on school.
It makes me sick.
It really is gross. And so anyway, this is somebody who has that problem. I guess it's a good problem to have once you've accumulated the money in the 529, but I would just probably save the money outside of a 529 and then decide whether you want to spend it on higher education. Yep. So this person is like, well, I've got the money now burning a hole in my pocket.
I can't do anything else with it or pass it on to future generations. I think that's one option with the 529. But geez,
I believe that there are other options. So this applicant who has money in the 529 enough to pay full tuition. So, you know, let's say that's $50,000 a year times three. So this is, let's say we've got 150 grand sitting in the 529 plan. You're admitted to a top 25 school with money.
Yep.
Waitlisted at a top 14 school. So not going to get money, even if you get in. The question is it worth mentioning on a letter of continuing interest, or is it just obnoxious? The worth mentioning is it worth telling them? So here's the letter. It would be basically, I have money in my 529. I'm willing to pay full tuition. And you say that on a letter of continuing interest to this top 14 school in an effort to get in off the wait list. What do you think about that move?
I mean, presumably, I don't know. On some level, right, you're saying, I got money and I'm willing to pay for it. But I was guessing that if they're waitlisting you, they're already expecting to charge you full freight anyway. So I don't know if it's helping. At least maybe they know you're willing to do that, whereas a lot of people aren't. So you're reducing that yield, right? Potential loss. So
exactly. Because if they admit you and then you're like, but I want a scholarship,
you're going to walk away possibly.
Then you're going to walk away.
You're more likely to walk away.
Yep. Yeah. You're going to walk away. You're going to hurt their yield. And I think that they really, they don't want to give you a scholarship. If they wanted to give you a scholarship, they would have already given you a scholarship. So they want your money.
Yeah.
And you flashing the cash, is it obnoxious? Sure. Does it work? Probably. You know, like, I don't know. You're trying to catch a taxi cab or something, right? It's like, if you hold lots of bills in your hand, I don't think that hurts your chances.
Okay.
Now, is this a good idea?
Yeah. Let's talk about that for a second. You can use your 509 plan.
529.
529 plan to cover. I think you can use it to cover room and board and like fees and books and other things. So
including other family members.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So we see people who have this money.
Yeah.
And they've got it earmarked for this one particular purpose. And then it's just burning a hole in their virtual pocket and they just like really want to spend it. But I tend to say, look up the rules for the 529 plan and think about all the other things. Ben says room and board. I say other family members for other types of programs. Law schools give ridiculous scholarships. Like, you don't get ridiculous scholarships for room and board.
And there are many other programs that you don't get ridiculous
scholarships for. Right, in undergrad. Right? And so I would consider whether you could use this money for your kids. Maybe you've got other siblings. Maybe you've got other nieces and nephews. Maybe you've got future degrees that in mind that you might want to spend the money on. It seems like you're overvaluing these T14s, I think don't pay for law school, period. And I just don't think that the school is so much better that it's worth wasting this money. I think you can find better uses for this 529 money.
Yeah, isn't there like an expiration? Or let's talk about this, the penalty for taking it out.
Oh, yeah, you could just take the money out.
Yeah, and you're not going to get as much as is in there, but boy, $100,000 is something, yeah, right?
If you hand it over to, you know, I'm assuming, by the way, that this is a T14 barely inside the T14, right? When people start talking about, well, I'm in it, a top 25, I start looking at the list of like, okay, who's ranked exactly
25.
Higher than 20, but lower than 25. I'm like, oh, so you're in at USC or so, wait, USC is probably actually, well, I don't know. You get the point. So you're barely inside the top 25. And when you say with money, that means probably partial scholarship or waitlisted at a top 14, which then I go, oh, so Georgetown, and they're not going to give you any money at all.
Mm-hmm.
I would like to know what other offers are on the table. Like, what's your best full ride?
Yeah. What about a T30,
exactly.
T35? And
what's your best full ride? That's the question. And this email doesn't really say that. I think you're wasting money at all these options. Just because you've got it in the 529, I don't think you should spend it. My final word on the matter is use this money for anything else. It might work, but I don't think that's a good reason to do it. Ben?
Yep, I agree. What is the withdrawal penalty? I'm just really curious now.
It's probably like you have to pay the taxes on the money and 10%.
That's exactly what it is. You have to pay the income tax and 10%. So if you assume 30% income tax, 10%, so you're losing 40% of it. That sucks. But boy, you get 60% cash.
Yeah. Or you could take it out
zero.
And you could take it out and give it to a charity. At which point you would then get the tax deduction. So paying tax on it wouldn't matter because you would deduct it immediately because you're going to give it to a charity. So you could pay 10% penalty and donate this to the American Cancer Society. Or keep 60% of it for yourself, or use it for a future education expense and 100% of it on any other future education expense, including possibly room and board while you're in law school. Paying it for tuition would be I just think it would be really dumb. I think it would be like a huge waste of money.
Yep.
Email daily at lsatdemon.com if you'd like to ask us a question or share some LSAT or law school admissions news. Thanks for listening.